This is Whiskey and IR Theory, a podcast where Dan Nexon, that's me, and Patrick Jackson, whose voice you will be hearing very shortly, sit around, drink some whiskey, talk about a classic work or works of IR theory. This is the second part of a two-part discussion of Discord in Collaboration by Arnold Wolfers. We talk a little bit about Wolfers and the book in the first podcast, so, you know, if you want some background, you should probably listen to that. I really don't have anything else to say. After the musical interlude, we're going to be talking about Chapter 5. Okay, Chapter 5, The Goals of Foreign Policy. What's your big takeaway from this?
Well, it's funny. This is one of those chapters where it's like we've talked through some of the things. Again, it's just there's some neat illustrations of it in here. You know, it's the goals of foreign policy. There are lots of different goals. Don't try to reduce them to just one. You know, it's perfectly reasonable that there could be goals that states have that involve, you know, producing more robust international institutions. But let's not assume that because those are the goals they're pursuing, they've given up the idea of having national goals. It's just that their national goals happen to involve that. So it is a very, in a way, it's a kind of moderate position. It's like states can make almost anything the object of their foreign policy, but it's always states making things the object of their foreign policy. So his critique of the idealist stuff, and I mean idealist in the technical sense here, that realist would use it. So on bottom of page 75, it's funny because that reference, that Cook and Moose, have you ever read that? The Cook and Moose book? So yeah. I read that years and years and years ago when I was writing a paper for Bob Jervis on the League of Nations, because the Cook and Moose were two of the quote-unquote idealists, right? Mm-hmm. And this is their definitive statement of this. But their argument is that these interests are actually quite realistic. And Wolfers' critique is very interesting here, because he says, sure, states can have milieu goals. States can have goals about trying to transform environments. But, as he says, they disregard the fact that no nation could hope to survive if it failed to be concerned about its own independence and territorial integrity, core possession goals of all nation states. So the house may not always be on fire, but if you perpetually ignore the fact that it might one day be on fire, then you're going to have a problem. So there's a check on how far you can go with your everything can be a goal, but you got to pull it back.
There's a passage I like on page 72 where he says, well, they have been misunderstood to hold that power, even maximum power, represent the only significant goal. And Spikeman, Morgenthau, they've contributed to this misapprehension because they just haven't phrased things very well. And then Morgenthau also stresses that power is only an immediate aim or chief means of foreign policy, while Spikeman, relating the quest for power to the task of survival, mentions the existence of other objectives that are geographic, demographic, racial, ethnic, economic, social, and ideological in nature. Yeah, you know, it's sort of the standard trick. You pull what you... I mean, obviously, these are people he knows, but you kind of pull out what suits your purpose. Mm-hmm. I've always said that if we didn't have realists who actually did make these arguments, we'd have to invent them. And so we do have some realists who come later who do, in fact, essentially come very close to this, and I don't think it's a misunderstanding or misapprehension to say so. No. But it is an interesting passage. The other thing that I wanted to note here, because we didn't address it earlier, is... it's very clear that he is writing in the 50s and in the late 40s. He's writing in a world where race matters a lot,
yeah.
And where racial norms and racial politics are a bit different than they are now. He refers to the white man and the colored man at one point earlier. And he takes it for granted that race is, you know, a lot, you know, he quotes Spikeman, taking it for granted that race is going to be a component of foreign policy. The thing is that he's not wrong, and you could even argue, there's an interesting discussion of this on Twitter, that race inflects U.S. foreign policy still much more than we like to admit. In fact, that's a very common argument these days in our field. But nonetheless, it is there, and you should be prepared for it. This, you know, this does not transcend its time in any way.
No.
So.
Also, all the
him,
states.
And it's always him and he.
Yep. You know. Except the states who are she's.
Yeah. Well.
So.
Like ships.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Chapter 6, The Role of Power and the Pole of Indifference. This is a odd and fascinating chapter. you mentioned it earlier, so I'm going to punt to you to summarize it.
So, in a way, what he's doing in this chapter, his poles, his pole of power and the pole of indifference, sort of serves two different functions. So on the one hand, they are hypotheticals that he uses to envision certain kinds of situations. So if every state was at the pole of power, which is to say looking to maximize its own power to achieve ends, versus if every state were kind of indifferent to each other, kind of what would these different systems look like? The overall argument here in the chapter seems to be something like, if states are trying to do anything, they're going to have to achieve a certain amount of power to work on those ends, which means that states can't be completely indifferent. But if they're too interested just in power for its own purposes, they're not going to achieve their ends anyway. So states have to navigate a course between these poles. So neither the vision of the world in which everybody's at the pole of power nor the vision where everybody's at the pole of indifference are accurate, and they're not particularly helpful. So on page 90, there is little reason to expect all actors on the international stage to orient themselves uniformly toward one and the same goal, whether it be peace, security, or power as an end in itself. So because states are going to be arranged differently on this continuum and they're going to be pursuing things in different kinds of ways, we have to take that into account. And while we can use the extremes as kind of baselines, we should not confuse those with actual empirical representations of what states are doing.
Yeah, and on page 92, we get the, I assume, the ontological security people quote or check this, right, where he argues the self. Well, what is the self anyway of the state? The self can vary a great deal. It can undergo a wide variety of interpretations. It may be considered to include only national independence and territorial integrity of the homeland, or may be held to embrace a whole catalog of, quote, vital interests, unquote, from safety belts and influence zones to investments in nationals abroad. Right. So, you know, even if we hold this, he said in an early chapter, he said that if we're going to use the state as actors assumption, there are a couple of assumptions we need to make about the inputs into state decision making. They're fairly thin. One of them is self-preservation. But here again, self-preservation, what that means varies widely, and it's not a kind of fixed quantity. It's much more the way we would think about kind of a narrative or rhetoric or ideology or set of outcomes from political processes than it is some essential characteristic of stateness. Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to pull out is he really makes the point that there is a distinction between being not liking the international system and the way that power, resources, values are distributed, and being a revisionist state. Right? That revisionism is essentially wanting to do something about it so much that you're willing to engage in aggressive behavior.
Right.
As he says repeatedly, every state would like to change things about international politics. Right. It says at one point that the United States would like to get rid of the communist bloc, but we call it a status quo state because primarily its interest is in maintaining a balance of power. We could debate this among revisionists and post-revisionists and neo-revisionists and neo-orthodox scholars of the Cold War, but nonetheless, you know, he draws this very important distinction. Preller kind of carries that out in his view by he has a nice way of putting it in his work, a willingness to accept costs. But this insight is really important, because if you don't have this insight, you cannot work with the category of revisionism. And this is something that, Steve Ward really drilled into my head when we were writing this piece on revisionism together. And I may have already said this in a podcast. I think it's really important.
But and he also has this great sort of line on 94-95 where he talks about how statesmen and peoples who hold or profess to hold strong beliefs in universal causes, religious or ideological, are not always found to minimize reliance on national power. So you can't simply take a goal which is universal or milieu goals or pacifist, you know, transformation of things and say, well, that would somehow mean that they wouldn't actually be pursuing power. That no, these goals might actually be justifications for pursuing all kinds of power. So you have to look not just at the goal itself. It reminds me, it's funny, because one of the things that is extremely apparent to me in reading this book is how much the figure that the self-proclaimed realists are arguing with in the United States is actually Woodrow Wilson. Wilson shows up all the time in this book.
So you're thinking about where he talks about why Wilson was able to do what he did?
Yes. And Wilson was able to do what he did precisely because there was power, and it was not a set of universal maxims. It was the fact that the United States had the power to put those into practice, which is a very traditional kind of realist reading of what Wilson is doing.
His phrasing here, though, is really interesting, and I think it's important in light of it's a version of conceptual vocabulary that comes back in the 80s and 90s around constructivism. But he talks about a self-abnegation.
Yeah.
He says the United States is powerful enough that it can essentially abdicate its own interests. It can do things that, in principle, might harm itself because it doesn't have to worry about the consequences. It also shows up in theories of hegemony. The reason why hegemons can do ordering the way this has been translated in a lot of hegemony theory is that they have the ability to seek long-term goals.
Mm-hmm.
So they can engage in short-term sacrifices for those long-term interests. And they have that luxury, the luxury of long-time horizons, because they enjoy such an asymmetry of power at the moment.
Right.
And that's where you get Grunberg's critique, which is then, but it's also supposed to end in tragedy, which seems a little weird. But somehow they have this amazing foresight, and yet they always wind up doing things that undercut themselves.
Yeah.
Think about that. But also, again, his real concern about the use of language of realpolitik to mask other interests. Right after the section I wrote about the variations of the national self, one of the implications of that for him, and the implication he moves immediately to, is that this language is used to cloak other things.
Right. Of realist work, right? Here is the ideology as it's been expressed, and it really camouflages something else. It has baser motives. It comes from some other place. And some of the extent to which realism functions as a critical theory is that unmasking. Right? Here are these universal pretensions, but we can actually show you that those universal pretensions are actually kind of wrapped up with the promotion of national goals and national power. Yes, it's justified in terms of needing the national power in order to pursue these noble goals, but if you look at it, what we're really doing is pursuing national power. So that kind of unmasking, which is exactly what Carr thought the function of realism was precisely to unmask the pretensions of these liberal ideals, but then dialectically to end up turning into a new set of ideals afterwards, because you can't live with realism alone if you're Carr. There's no dialectic in Wolfers. There's a way in which countries, states, state leaders are always involved in the use of power, that there's almost no pure examples of pole of indifference, but there's also almost no examples of pole of pure pursuit of power for its own sake. So everybody is kind of in the middle someplace.
Yeah. And this is, again, the sort of pragmatism on page 100.
Yeah.
He makes the point that often comes up in the context of contemporary debates about realism, and particularly offensive realism, which is to say, hey, if the world works this way, why are you spending all this time trying to why do you need to argue that it works this way? Why are you spending all this time telling policymakers that they're screwing up because they're not behaving in the way that you say they have to behave in? And he says, on 100, realists would not be so eager, as was Machiavelli himself, to impress their governments with the necessity, again in quotation marks, of playing the game of power politics as consistently as their opponents, were it not for fear that their governments might act with too much restraint.
Bingo.
And he actually thinks that to be clear, he thinks that prudent restraint is really important. And this comes up again, again, and again. He invokes at one point the security dilemma. There's several, the inevitable discussion times. Of nuclear weapons. He actually is, I think, concerned that people confuse prudent restraint with self-abnegation.
Yeah. Yeah, and you end up with, in his sort of summary statement on the bottom of 101, the realist school has merited its name for having appreciated the role the quest for power plays in international politics, et cetera, et cetera. Lying somewhere within a continuum that stretches from the pole of an all-out struggle for power to the pole of an all-round indifference to power, the actual world tends to be pulled more strongly toward the former. So the problem is that because of the way that international politics is organized, or politics is organized, you're closer toward the power end, needing power to do various things. And therefore, the danger is that people will ignore that. And it's strange, because having just spent a chapter or two demolishing the idea that there are necessities, he then tacitly endorses the language of necessity when it's required to pull policymakers back in the direction of recognizing that power is important. And this will also inform later on his view of balancing and collective security and the way that he thinks that security policy should be pursued.
Sorry. Kibbeth, you're really distracting when you're drooling on me. She drools on me. This cat drools on me. Do your cats drool on you?
Not really. They're not really droolers.
Yeah, she drools. She just sits there and she drools.
Wow.
So it is, of course, fun and in some ways naive to go through old books looking for things that you like and then having the warm fuzzy that it affirms something about your beliefs because, look, this text we're supposed to respect says it. Nonetheless, he has this discussion in 56, 57. Again, we're back to restraint. We're back to the idea that actually sometimes you want to make peace. Sometimes if you want to get rid of enmity, you have to show self-restraint. He says, whenever the lines of enmity are not irreparably drawn, there may remain room for moderation and self-restraint, for better understanding each other's true designs, and for fair compromise. Well, in the end, it needs two to make friends. It is not always the other side that must take the first step. And then he says, only those who extol the value of national virility, in quotation marks, which is supposed to express itself in obstinate resistance to compromise, or those who are afraid of being the suckers will insist that the necessity of state is always on the side of toughness and unrelenting assertion of national claims.
Yep.
Piece of change.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, this is where it's like there's a certain value to just. And someone who has read an awful lot of international history who can then just kind of draw up not quite generalizations, but more general claims that draw together some of these things. I'm like, well, sometimes it's this and sometimes it's that, and here are the things to watch out for. There's something to the sort of lessons of history. And Wolfer seems to be is one of these people who's very good at drawing these kinds of lessons in language that still resonates. I mean, who's concerned with national virility and talks
about being played for suckers?
You're right, and the sorts of policies that there's this marvelous example, this marvelous analysis of Trump's foreign policy that was done by a colleague of mine at Aberystwyth, and Jenny Mathers, and her argument was Putin would always be able to play Trump because Putin represents the masculinized ideal that Trump aspired to. So all Putin had to do was basically show up and, like, be manly, and subtly suggest that Trump wasn't being manly enough to get Trump to do basically exactly what he wanted him to do. And that turned out to be pretty accurate. There is a, you know...
That Trump wasn't himself manly enough to ensure that that translated into U.S. foreign policy. And
no.
Luckily, some of the worst impulses were blocked.
Exactly.
By the hawks in his administration.
But certainly only those who are afraid of being the suckers and are interested in national virility will insist that the necessity state's always on the side of toughness. I mean, that could be talking points. That could be.
And this is also, you know, you think about Obama's, you know, we can extend the, what is it, the velvet hand, but then have the fist. Mm-hmm. Essentially, there's no harm in coming to people and say, let's talk, as long as you're willing to get tough when that doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
And I remember he was castigated for being naive for that, and I think feminized. All right, so this is a really terrific chapter. It's really interesting. There are lots of cool little nuggets. Again, it can be a little frustrating in the sense that he always seems to walk things, you know, it can feel often like he says one thing and then he says another thing. I think we've tried to hammer home the idea that there is some consistency there. He makes some points that I think are fairly astute. They also show up in later realist writings. You know, for example, he says, look, if it were possible to have the kind of friendship that it would enable world government, we wouldn't need the world government in the first place.
Right, exactly.
Which I actually think is not a good argument.
It's clever.
But the problem with argument is exactly what he's told us, which is that that friendship is fragile, mm-hmm. right? And so, and he's saying, you know, if we had such robust friendship that we could get world government, but you know, he's already told us that really robust friendship can go the way of the dodo. Mm-hmm. So in fact, maybe you, under those circumstances, you would want to move affirmatively to lock in some sort of supranational governance, precisely to prevent a repeat of what happened after World War II.
And this is where, say, the Karl Deutsch argument about the practical construction of international community through transactional ties comes in. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. then it's not about relying on particular kind of subjective emotional states or whatever. It's about these concrete sociological transactions between mm-hmm. groups, which Wolfer doesn't have that language. He doesn't use that. So, but if he did... You know, then it would be interesting because if he were to use that language, now he couldn't. He couldn't use that language consistently because it would actually mean he'd have to go back and redo that whole first chapter about the actor's international politics. And you'd have to have a very different conception of what an actor was in order to be able to introduce that kind of sociological meso level into the analysis. So he sort of cut himself off from that possibility because it's really been divided up into just these two. There's individuals, there's states.
So, Chapter 7, Power and Influence, the Means of Foreign Policy. Essentially, the big important move he makes in this chapter is to distinguish between power and influence. Mm-hmm. His main argument is that they should be thought of as analytically distinctive. Influence is more about persuasion, peaceful change, as it were. Power is about coercion. These two things often go together. He talks about how diplomats kind of prefer influence, and you know, this is a theme that comes up repeatedly, that people who are practitioners in certain kinds of instruments of statecraft tend to prefer those instruments, and so you just have to kind of be a little bit careful. Mm-hmm. We can imagine, and it is true, that there are advantages to being weak, that sometimes weak states can be more successful. Mm-hmm. In part because they might be able to be influential. Oftentimes, their power of the weak is actually an example of their influence with powerful states in the terms that he's drawn this distinction.
It's very there's a lot of like shades of shelling in here. Which makes sense because, and he cites Schelling on a couple of occasions, but Schelling was also part of the same community, particularly since at this point, I think Schelling is still at Rand. So there's a lot of that kind of policy overlap going on there. But of course, what Wolfers keeps coming back to again and again is there are these two different things. We need to distinguish between them, but we can't get too caught up with either one of them as the universal solution.
Yeah.
Because, as he says on 113, because of the need for a wide variety of means of coercion and of persuasion, a nation is best prepared for future contingencies if it is equipped with a whole arsenal of means appropriate to varying uses, which in maxim terms is very much a kind of Machiavellian maxim, right? Don't get too attached to particular means because you may need different means at different times. And if you get completely wrapped up with one or the other extreme, then you may either become too warlike or you may be taken advantage of. So you need to be able to balance between them.
It also conjures up the whole line of argument, which we've talked about before, that largely by non-realists, that realists went astray in the 80s by becoming too obsessed with military power. Essentially, I think that realism for a while became essentially the argument that realism, let's be blunt, realism often in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s often turned to the argument that military power was the master explanatory variable.
Yes.
Right. Which is not at all what realists from so-called classical realists, it's not at all what they sound like. Mm-hmm. Even those who say it's the final reason in international politics. Right. And now, of course, we're coming back to that. Realists have been driven by events to study influence, to study subversion. It's interesting that Wolfers, I'm not sure where it is now. I didn't write it down. But he talks about how there are sort of fads about how to do power and influence.
Right.
So he talks about, and he talks about in the 20s, the fad was sanctions, like you would do economic sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the Second World War, the fad becomes subversion.
Right.
In propaganda, you're going to destabilize other regimes and you're going to foment revolution in them. He points out that there are limitations of that strategy, which are driven home by 1956 Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
You can support uprisings all you want, but if you're not going to come to their aid militarily when they face a superior foe, they're going to get crushed.
Right.
So, again, we come back to this position that, it's military force is going to matter a lot. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, we're in a period of where the fads are for sanctions, very much so.
Right.
And for a bit of subversion on the side, particularly if you are a state that's incapable of using sanctions as an instrument. So we're kind of going through this stuff all over again.
Mm-hmm.
But fundamentally, I think that you have kind of two elements there that I think are just absolutely important. The first being the recognition of multiple instruments and the implicit rebuke to a realism that would come to neglect these other, not only neglect instruments, but neglect influence.
Right.
Right. Say that influence is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing, of course, for me, that's really interesting is the idea that states have toolkits that change over time in terms of the mixture of instruments they think are going to be really effective.
No, I think you pretty much nailed it. It's again, the consistent piece of Wolfers' advice is don't get too enamored of any particular technique and be aware of the kinds of fads that you can fall into. That you need to be able to judge situations individually. And yes, it's important not to lose sight that power is involved, but that doesn't always mean you reach for your coercive instrument, which I think is interestingly informs what's going to happen in the next four or five chapters. In a way, these all kind of hang together, right? Because you've got we talk about the balance of power, and the particular question that seems to be animating the next several chapters of the book is, does, and Korea is important here, The Korean War is a tremendously important recurring example throughout this. Does the fact that a UN-sanctioned coalition went to war to punish what was called a breach of the peace mean that something has fundamentally changed in international relations? Have we actually transcended the balance of power? Have we moved into some entirely different system? And Wolfers generally comes down on the side of no, there are some things that have changed sort of minorly in terms of the way we signal this. We signal who's broken the peace and whatever, but fundamentally we're still talking about the same basic dynamics, just a different way of practicing the balance.
Yeah, I would stress, because I know we're going to skip over most of what's in here, I would stress that the Balance of Power essay is one of the important classic essays if you want to do your potted genealogy of the balance of power concept in IR. You know, along with Haas and a couple of others, this is one of the how do we define the balance of power essays that often gets read. It's pretty good on that score. He has a nice discussion of different ways of thinking about the balance of power. But it's not just about conceptual clarification. He does come out advocating a balance of power strategy for the United States. Because the United States cannot hope to achieve world hegemony, so the balance of power is the other way to go. Very interesting conclusion. That's on 131. Mm-hmm. He says that the balance of power is a perfectly fine substitute for supremacy. So a lot of this is aimed against power maximization strategies, not because they're never useful. He talks about times when they're useful, potentially, but because they, they're not necessarily prudent, and they're certainly not going to work for the United States right now. I would assume this is a rebuke of some of the more hardline rollback positions that are floating around in debates at the time.
Well, and given where it originally appeared, right? It's a revised version of an article originally appearing in the Naval War College Review in January 1959. So clearly, right, he is. Engaging with those kinds of extreme rollback, we don't like containment because it's too soft on communism kinds of positions. So,
and then you know he makes some interesting arguments that I think are Tito proves that ideology is not necessarily always going to trump other kinds of considerations, which is another reason why the United States doesn't have to set out to eliminate all communist regimes. Again, I think is the subtext here, right? Blood of national security is thicker than ideology, I think is more or less the way he puts it. Anything right. in the other chapters that right. I think they're interesting. I think there's a lot potentially going on, but I don't know that there are things that we have a lot to say about.
No, I mean, I think there is an interesting discussion. I honestly had almost no idea what to make of Chapter 9 about deterrence and accommodation, where it's one of these situations where it's clear that he's involved in some set of debates that were important at the time, but I'm not quite sure what they are. I don't know enough of the historical context.
This is a very traditional argument, and it's an argument that it's an evergreen argument. Because if you look at a lot of what he's saying explicitly, where he builds to in the article, it's essentially that deterrence can work against leaders even if you think that they are a little bit crazy. He says, "I do not propose to inquire here," this is on 137, "into the validity of the underlying psychological thesis, which reminds one of the similar ethical thesis ascribing all initiation of war to the actions of evil men. No doubt many wars have been the work of mad or vicious men, but I would argue that the Hitlerian wars of the mad Caesars are the exception rather than the rule. Yet even if the neurosis thesis were correct, it is hard to see how governments to whom it might appeal could go about eliminating the disease of neurotics in every nation from whose ranks future mad Caesars and their followers could be drawn." We talked about this earlier. And so ultimately we come back to the idea that you can pursue a policy of deterrence. he has this discussion about, you know, again, this sort of idea of psychological screening. Could you couldn't weed out the neurotics, so even if psychological instability or infirmity or neuroses is what caused war, there's not that much you could do about it. So he's going through these arguments, right, about, you know, Hitler and mad Caesars, and really we can't do much to prevent that. And then he says, so one way you might deal with this is you would engage in a massive educational and socialization program to weed out aggressiveness. If you really believe that, like, aggressive, hopped up testosterone or crazy men were causing war, your remedy would be to set about, you know, kind of neutralizing those people or making sure they don't exist or socializing people out of aggression. He says, you know, look, the problem is if you made all your people non-aggressive, then other countries would be aggressive and you would have a problem, right? You'd have an aggressiveness gap. Right? Then he says, he calls this, the result would be a unilateral psychological disarmament and a dangerous undermining of peace efforts based on deterrence. So again, the implication of all of these arguments is back to, you know, deterrence is the best instrument in our arsenal. So in that sense, it mirrors the balance of power chapter. You know, these might be imperfect. They might be great. Maybe you want to eliminate war. Maybe you don't really want to go around threatening to kill everybody in a nuclear fireball, you know, if the Russians invade West Germany. But this is kind of what we got, you know.
Although it is interesting that he, and this is perhaps not surprising for someone who was,
because this is strategies of deterrence and accommodation.
Right. So we do end up with accommodation is sometimes useful, and mediators are useful, and there can be really impartial mediators, and they can actually help, but the UN can't actually be an ideal mediator because it can't set up acceptable mediatory boards or committees unless at least chairman can be found who are recognized as neutrals by both parties. So you need to have real neutrals. And he doesn't name any real neutrals in here, but once again, perhaps not surprising for someone from Switzerland to be talking about the importance of that kind of mediation. So, no, we shouldn't just be aggressive with our enemies. We should engage in deterrence because it's the least bad alternative, but there are these neutral mediators who can maybe help.
So one way of thinking about the debates about the origins of the Second World War is that essentially you have... So we've talked a lot about idealism versus realism at the level of something like the League of Nations, but there's also the Chamberlain side of the debate, where you contrast robust military deterrence, reliance on hard power instruments, with appeasement, with trying to bring about peace by making concession, by accommodation. And so a lot of, you know, when we talk about the Munich analogy as being a potent analogy in foreign policy ever since, but one of the things that Wolfers is essentially doing here is saying that deterrence and accommodation are not opposites. Right? Deterrence is one of the ways you get accommodation, and accommodation is often the goal of deterrence. What is deterrent? Mm-hmm. What else is deterrence but being in a position where you kind of agree to accommodate one another because you're mutually deterred?
Right.
And so he wants to say, you know, not all, accommodation is not appeasement. Appeasement is when you, he says appeasement is a form of accommodation where you give up a lot for a little. But beyond that, accommodation's fine.
It goes back to his general sense that we should be evaluating state policies in terms of the different kinds of value trade-offs that they represent. So the problem with appeasement would be that it's a trade-off of something valuable for not a lot that is valuable. But with accommodation, you're either giving away something that's not all that valuable, or you are preserving something that is actually more valuable. So that kind of multifaceted definition of state goals can accommodate this. Once again, it seems to be inveighing against, you know, charges that somebody who is not pursuing an aggressive policy is somehow being soft.
Right, and of course he ends up at the end of the chapter making a case for prudent, careful arms control. It's not disarmament, It can make things better. It's not going to be necessarily easy to bring about. So yeah, I think this is, I mean, I think it would be helpful if we knew the precise context of some of these interventions, but it's pretty clear what the general parameters of the people he's arguing with are. Right. So
yeah. No, I think that's clear. And then we have chapter 10.
Take it away, Patrick.
So, I mean, like I think I said before, this is a chapter I assign. I actually assign regularly to my first year international relations undergrads. This is a marvelous chapter, precisely because he manages to both skewer the idea that there's any one thing called a national security policy, but does so without saying that therefore anything and everything can and should be regarded as national security. So he, to use language he doesn't use, he identifies the semantic instability of the phrase national security without turning it into complete indeterminacy. So the term security itself doesn't necessarily have a single meaning. It can mean a variety of different things. Ultimately, we have to go back to thinking about the sorts of values that are being utilized here. The idea of national security, while it, what does he say? He says it represents a particular notion that we should be putting the interests of the nation first, or the security of the nation first, but that doesn't really tell us exactly what we ought to be doing. So that's sort of not specific enough. But what it does is, what he does in the chapter very effectively is say, even if we are pursuing a policy of national security, which he thinks we should be pursuing, that rules out certain things, but it doesn't give us an unequivocal set of marching orders. And there's a lot of room for debate here, a lot of room for discussion based on different kinds of national values. And so you have a position that is what you might call practically constructivist, in that security doesn't have an objective meaning that can dictate things, but it isn't a strong social theoretical claim about how meanings emerge from social patterns of interaction or something like that. So when it points to, you think of something like page 163, far be it from a political scientist to claim any particular competence in deciding what efforts for national security are or are not morally justified. What he can contribute here is to point to the ambiguities of any general normative statement that security be bought at whatever price it may cost. So it's, the campaign here is to take the notion of it's security, therefore everything is justified. So take that rhetorical weapon out of the hands of people who would securitize things and say, no, that's not what we should be doing here. Remember that these are moral issues. Remember that these are trade-offs. And because these are trade-offs, we should be skeptical of these arguments that quote-unquote national security demands that we do some particular...
Where he winds up with this, again, very much along the lines of what you were saying at the bottom, page 165, he says, because public opinion can swing really easily between kind of complacency, oh, everything's wonderful, fine, we don't need to do anything to protect ourselves, we don't need to worry about our security, to extreme apprehension, he says, from utopian reliance on goodwill to disillusioned faith in naked force only. For these reasons, it's really important to be wary of any simple guide, even one that parades in the realist garb of a policy directed solely by the national security interest.
Bingo.
There's a lot more to say about this chapter, but we are running low on time, and I think it's a chapter that, it's not, I don't think it's that complicated, it's just interesting and you should read it.
If I could just quote one line from it before we move on, which is on page 150, where he gives his quote-unquote definition of security. Security, in an objective sense, measures the absence of threats to acquired values, and in a subjective sense, the absence of fear that such values will be attacked. But then he spends the next 10 pages talking about how the both the objective and the subjective sense really can't be determined in advance and have to be worked out by particular people at particular times. So it's a definition that's sort of not a definition.
That's the whole point, right?
Right. But what it does is it gives that, it's a maxim, as you said before. It's a particular kind of guidance. It's like, all right, if we almost think about it almost like the Kantian categorical imperative, right? It doesn't have any content, but it's a procedure you're supposed to go through. So, okay, cool. So we're going to try to determine if we're going to have security. So let's see. What are the threats to our acquired values, and how much fear do we have that those values are actually going to be attacked? So he's like giving us a procedure for how you would determine whether you were secure or not. From a practical policy standpoint, it makes a lot of sense. From a theoretical explanatory standpoint, you can do nothing with this sentence except say, all right, what we have to now examine are the processes by which countries or political systems or groups or whatever come to some understanding of values and threats. So it points in a certain kind of research direction, which he's then not actually going to be going into here, because what he's really trying to do here is give advice to policymakers. If you are trying to make decisions about these things, ask yourself these kinds of questions, and remember the security is only one value that you could have, so there are trade-offs associated with it. So you can see who he's arguing with. He's arguing with everybody who would hold up national security as being the trump card. And saying, no, that's not it. That's not, was he saying, 164, it follows that policies of national security, far from being all good or all evil, may be morally praiseworthy or condemnable depending on their specific character and the particular circumstances of the case. That very much to me sounds like the conclusion of my favorite chapter of The Prince, which is Machiavelli's chapter on fortresses. Where he says, well, basically at the end we can conclude that fortresses are either useful or not useful depending on circumstances.
I love that
because I love that chapter.
But that's a really important point. Sometimes they're useful and sometimes they're not.
It's a really important point. It's really important. Like, don't put all your faith in one means. Don't put all your faith in this one strategy. Instead, realize that every strategy has times when it's going to be useful and times when it's not going to be useful. It's a very useful thing. I will always go off on a rant about this when I have my undergrads read Machiavelli, and they're like, this is boring. Like, who cares about fortresses? I'm like, it's not about fortresses. It's his example. It's not about the particular technique. It's about needing to change with the times. And I think Wolfers, even though he only uses Machiavelli in the negative sense of like Machiavellianism as being the pure power position, but there is something very similar here between Wolfers and Machiavelli if we read Wolfers and Machiavelli as political theorists.
Well, also if we just read, right? Machiavelli's The Prince in the broader context of his writings and pay attention to what he actually says in The Prince.
Well, yes, that would also help. But if we read it that way, then in many ways what Wolfers is saying is very similar to that Machiavellian position of don't take an extreme categorical position. Examine circumstances. React to circumstances. Look for the things that seem to be enduringly true as lessons of experience. Now, caveat about how bad Machiavelli's history was that he was drawing on to draw all these lessons. But it's the same kind of argumentative style. And Wolfers is doing something very similar. Here are things that we know from watching and working in international politics, and here are some general lessons we can draw from this, and we have to take them all with a grain of salt because they're all contextual, and at the end of the day, nothing substitutes for individuals being able to make these sorts of decisions, but we can at least help them make better decisions by perhaps counseling them about some of the stupid things that they might have done.
Chapters are about collective security, and we're far enough along, and I've had enough to drink, that my notes are looking a little hazy, and I'm always, this is the point where I start worrying that I'm going to misrepresent things. So, grain of salt, territory. But by and large, the way I read these two chapters, the overall message, there's some really interesting stuff in it, particularly about the U.S. alliance system. But the overall kind of thrust of these chapters is you probably really shouldn't do collective security. and don't confuse some of the things that might look to you like collective security as collective security. Korea was not really collective security. And NATO is not really collective security. Collective defense is very different, he argues, from collective security. Keep them. It's easy to confuse. He'll say over and over again, it's easy to get confused. They sound a lot alike, but they're not the same thing. And one of the reasons this matters is that he has, a very nice account. Look, I like it because he talks about I'm going to like this. He talks about the United States as sitting at the center of a hub of a wheel with allies distributed around the periphery. And he talks about the way that this creates cross pressures for the United States because actors on one part of the wheel don't really care about the actors on the other part of the wheel, and they don't have the same interests. And by the way, when the United States wants to like give assurances by being more credible and tough to some on one part of the wheel, people on the states on the other part of the wheel, they're leaders are going to be like, and their populations are going to be like, holy shit, the United States is aggressive. We don't want to get dragged and entrapped in a conflict, right? So it's sort of, it's sort of proto Glenn Snyder, but it's got some network stuff in it, and I think it's pretty astute. Mm-hmm. He talks in particular about the way that things like overseas bases create these political dimensions for the U.S. security management that are really important, mm-hmm. and they're difficult, but the United States can probably do it, but they are hard. Yeah. And we have to be wary of them. This is, of course, an era where we are talking about things like France pulling out of NATO, where we're talking about other tensions within NATO, but also between the Pacific security issues and European security issues. So, there's a lot mm-hmm. of kind of stuff going on here. And he really does emphasize that the United States system of security is a collective defense system. It really does depend on an alliance structure in a way that is very different from a lot of the other states that we've looked at in the past, in a way which is different from the Soviet system, because that's really kind of quasi-imperial.
I will say that when his argument about the downside of having the United Nations designated aggressor, as soon as he, and it certainly that's not a note that I made the first time I read this book because you hadn't come up with the argument yet, but when I read it, I was like, oh gosh, this sounds very much like the process Dan talks about when multivocal signaling falls apart, when suddenly you have categorical ideological or religious claims where you can't equivocate anymore. You can no longer multivocally signal. You have to take one side or the other. And as soon as you do that, then it makes your control relations a bit more brittle. You can no longer hold that kind of disparate network together. So all of his discussions of the dangers of the clarity of that kind of collective security thing, and how it would be easier if we just relied on notions of collective defense against aggressors. I was like, oh, I've heard this argument somewhere before. So it did sound to me very much like as if you were kind of channeling.
And this is, and probably I was, right? I just didn't know it. He also, another example of this, you're right. It's important to stress that he is very concerned with the way that collective security interacts with the political structural dynamics of the U.S. alliance network. And one of the examples is he says, look, it kind of turned out okay, the Suez Crisis, because of popular opinion in Britain turned out to not really freak out as much as they might have. But we kind of lucked out on that. And this is an example of how we don't want to let collective security propositions get in the way of collective defense propositions when there's a clash between them.
Right.
So that's pretty interesting, I think. And in one way it's very orthodox realism, right? Don't let kind of things that the League says you need to do or that the League charter says you need to do get in the way of your power political interests, right? In that sense, it's very traditional. But in another sense, it's a really interesting way of kind of getting granular on the subject. Right. It's a really interesting way of thinking about the practical dimensions of competing value propositions in international politics. And here is a situation where mm-hmm. he is taking a side on values. Right. But he's saying that the reason to take that side on the values proposition is essentially that we can't reconcile these two things very well, and one of them is much is that's the, we've set up this robust alliance system, and we've got this UN thing, which kind of and so of course you're going to want the robust alliance thing, particularly because as he's been telling us in past chapters, we don't want to pursue universal domination. We need to pursue balancing. We need to hold this right. thing together. That's the way we're going to protect ourselves against the Soviets.
Yeah. No, exactly. And it's the fear that realists often express, that desire for the universally good will interfere with the practical good enough. And if we get too concerned about pursuing these maximal ideals, then we're going to end up doing ourselves out of what's actually making the system work. So all of the way that he takes apart the ways that this collective security language is really about a collective defense pact, I think is quite insightful, the way he kind of pulls it apart. Now, it's interesting also the time-boundness of it, because he's, again, very worried that the French are going to somehow leave the alliance, and they did, and it didn't really matter. But that actually helps to prove his point, which is that ultimately this is about questions of countries calculating their interests, and if countries are calculating their interests in particular ways, I mean, France leaving NATO was never about France deciding that it was somehow going to go side with the Soviet Union. It was about France not wanting to be part of an integrated command structure. And they were still in a level that Wolfers doesn't look at, there's still huge amounts of practical cooperation and coordination between the French military and various NATO structures during the whole time.
But that's it's not obvious. Like, it is not obvious what's going to happen when France starts arguing that it's going to pull out, making noise about it, and then when it pulls out, this is a big deal, and it leads to a renegotiation of what how the alliance actually works. So we have the benefit of hindsight.
I don't
right?
disagree. No, I don't want to be misheard as I'm taking Wolfers to task for being too concerned about this. I guess what I'm saying is the way history actually turned out kind of demonstrates his point a little bit more than he's afraid that the French leaving would mean that France would turn into a neutral or neutralist and or possibly even then go inside with the Soviet Union. And what actually happens is that France ends up militarily continuing to cooperate with the rest of the NATO bloc. And if Wolfers is right that at the end of the day what states should be doing is pursuing policies that are more about their own understanding of their values and their interests than about their formal institutional commitments, well, he's right. That's sort of what France did. So his insight is kind of borne out by this.
So if the lesson of that chapter, among other things, is don't let collective security commitments get in the way of collective defense commitments, then the next chapter is, you know, an extension of this logic. This is where he does the hub and spoke thing. This is an extension of this logic to actually a lot of just good intrinsic stuff about cross pressures in the US alliance system, but also then extended to the problem of neutrals. Okay, I'm not sure I understood this argument correctly, so I'm going to say something and you're going to tell me whether I'm right or not. Kind of the way I read this argument is that the logic of the U.S. collective defense system, the logic of the U.S. alliance system, is to create two blocks, and that it's to really, like, suck every non-communist state into this alliance system to essentially contain the Soviet Union. And non-aligned and neutral countries are a problem for that strategy. They essentially, because they won't join. And so they create these special dilemmas because not only will they not join, it's not like they're genuinely neutral on everything.
Yeah. No, he makes this distinction, right? So you've got neutrals and you've got neutralists. So true neutrals, almost think of it as like a D&D alignment chart, right? So true neutrals are a problem in that because they haven't joined, if you extend benefits to them, then you might piss off people who have joined. your particular block. So you just kind of have to be careful not to like extend them too many favors. But they're true neutrals, so they're not really trying to side with the others either, so they're not really that important. It's the neutralists that he's really concerned about, because these are the groups that say we're not aligned, but they are pursuing other kinds of maximal transformative goals. And because they are pursuing goals, and in particular because they are pursuing goals that are not power political goals but are ideological goals, then they might side with the other power if the other power seems to be pushing more their direction. And since the neutralists are basically anti-colonial, then he's afraid that the Soviet Union's rhetoric about capitalism having caused colonialism might incline them to actually side with the Soviets. So then the neutralists are not neutral. And so the, what does he say on 228? The United States must avoid adding to the lures of neutrality while at the same time rewarding it where it replaces neutralist unneutrality, in quotation marks. So real neutrals, there's a problem with, because you've just got to be careful that you're not showing them any favor that would then piss off people who are actually part of your alliance. But neutrals are better than neutralists. So if you can get a neutralist to move into the neutral category, then you're doing good. It's not always necessary that they join. If you can just get them out of that neutralist category, which he says is not really a neutral category, and actually make them like really neutral, then you're okay. So it is a very sophisticated management strategy for bipolarity. And it relies on that distinction between two different groups of neutrals. Now, it's a sophisticated great power management strategy for a bipolar world. And it is what I might expect of someone like Wolfers. You know, these are pieces of advice that he's giving to the United States. Don't ignore the neutrals. Don't go overboard trying to get the neutrals to join your camp. Don't extend so many benefits to neutrals to get them to join your camp that you end up annoying members of your own
coalition. Well, I think it's worth looking at what he says to conclude on 216. He's said a couple of times that communist countries are going to exploit missteps by the United States, labeled aggressive, accuse the United States of transforming its allies into satellites. He doesn't believe that's generally the case. He says, because American policy has been forced by the circumstances of the Cold War to place more emphasis than is popular on military defense and the preservation of order, the United States is falsely identified in many quarters with social reaction and militarism, a fact not conducive to the smooth operation of collaborative policies that depend on broad public support. Under such circumstances, an effort to create a favorable image of the United States in the minds of other peoples is not a negligible part of a policy of going it with others. That makers of American alliance policy are faced with an impressive set of adverse circumstances does not mean that they are relieved of the responsibility for success or failure. Stormy weather and treacherous currents are no excuse for shipwrecks that able navigation could have avoided. Even if the stresses and strain imposed by conditions beyond the control of the United States are inescapable, there is still enough leeway for different courses of action to justify the contention that the final outcome will depend substantially on the wisdom of the actual policy choices and of the attitudes on which those choices rest. There's a lot going on there, actually, as we've tried to sort of work around this chapter. But I think that's kind of the point, isn't there? I mean, I think that's what you said, right? The point of this is that this is really difficult. You have to be very careful about not treating states that are not a problem as if they are a problem. You've got to be ginger in your handling of the states that are a problem. You've got to be thinking about how all these things interact with your alliance system and the way you're managing other neutrals all the time. And part of this is actually, you know, and it's interesting because he says, you know, he basically absolves the United States. I mean, I would be a little careful about that. The United States, well, it's weird. He, like, first says the United States has been forced into this position. So, unfortunately, it looks pretty bad sometimes, even though it's not the fault of its own. But it's actually valuable to look good. And it doesn't really absolve you of doing things that do make you look bad. So, I mean, I guess this is a political document, too.
Right. Yeah, well, this is always the thing with Wolfers, though, right? It's you shouldn't base your policy on morality, mm-hmm. but all policies are actually moral choices. So you shouldn't go out and deliberately do bad things, mm-hmm. but sometimes you have to go out and do bad things, and you should be aware of that. But you shouldn't minimize that kind of choice that you have to make. Certainly, one of the questions that is raised by this typology is exactly how you figure out who fits in the category of being a neutral versus who's a neutralist. And he's thinking of specific states, but he doesn't give you any sort of exhaustive criteria for figuring out who fits in what category, but that's part of the
chapter
point.
Which comes after the one I just read, which is where he really lays out this neutrals, neutralist, and allies category. You're right. But it's very clear from what we just read who some of the names are, right? But it is interesting here because he comes back to this idea that essentially the United States, he has this great line in 228, thus the United States must avoid adding to the lures of neutrality while at the same time rewarding it where it replaces neutralist unneutrality. Right. Yeah. And this is back to what he says before, which exactly. I think is important because you emphasized there's actually a lot of interesting structural dynamics here. And it comes back to this point. It's not just cross pressures and all that, but he makes the point, and I almost raised it, but then I didn't, and I guess I will raise it now. He says, one of the interesting things about getting a relatively stable balance is that it makes it possible for states to be neutral, right? If power is balanced, they don't have to worry so much about aggression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they can kind of free ride on that security provision,
right?
That results from the balance. And not only can they do that, they can start trying to play you off against each other. They can start looking for good deals. They can start playing that game because they're relatively secure now. In a way that maybe Germany wasn't, right? In the 19, when the Cold War started, right? They have this luxury now. These new nations that have entered the scene that have chosen neutrality have a luxury that the other states did not have. And so this dynamic is particularly interesting because there's also this dimension of not only managing them, but not treating them so well that your allies conclude that they can move into that camp too. So you're right, it's just all about like this omnipresence of trade-offs.
Right. And it presumes something really interesting too, right? Because it presumes that projects of systemic transformation are always mm-hmm. ideological cover for something else. So I think in this context, I think of something like Adam Getachew's book, right? Where she's talking about the way that the post-colonial states are really looking not just to establish their own national independence, but at least initially, it's her argument, they're looking to kind of rewrite the rules of what it means to be an independent state. Mm-hmm. And so it really is a kind of transformation. For Wolfers, that doesn't look like a transformation. For Wolfers, it's, clearly their goal is national independence because that's kind of what states want. And therefore, everything else that they're saying is just some sort of ideological overstretch that these neutralists are doing. And that's what makes them dangerous because they're going to end up siding with Soviets
careful.
Who also have this line of systemic transformation.
Right.
And but this is a management problem for him, right? You can stop them from doing this if you throw them enough benefits to turn them from neutralists into pure neutrals. So it's about managing the system, which is ultimately about
avoiding certain states. Because where this chapter ends up, the very last paragraphs are essentially don't intervene in the affairs of states just because they're making noises about national self-determination and national solidarity, and they sound kind of socialist blocky. He says, don't do that. mm-hmm. The danger remains that some ally or some neutralist country may be blinded to its own best interests by fear or resentment and turn its back on the United States and the West generally. This is not about, the Soviets, being the primary agents luring it away. This is about the United States doing something to screw things up.
Oh, no.
Like terrifying them or making them pissed off about their treatment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If such cases can be kept at a minimum, the United States should be capable of taking the loss if it occurs and of compensating for it elsewhere, maintaining that flexibility. Whereas it would be folly to ignore the value of allied solidarity and the usefulness mm-hmm. of neutralist benevolence, it is defeatist and exposes the United States to dangerous blackmail besides to assume that American defense position is dependent on a favorable attitude on the part of each and every American ally or all in each every group of neutralist states. Right. And what he concludes with is, you know, basically don't intervene in some of these countries unless they are very clearly aggressive Soviet bloc states. Right. So this is, I would assume, I don't know. I don't know what he thought right. about some of these interventions. Like, you could use this decision criteria and erroneously conclude that overthrowing our bends was okay. Right. I don't think you would use this criteria and conclude overthrowing Mossadegh was okay. Right. The criteria does mean right. you don't overthrow our bends either. Right. I mean, a lot of contemporary right. realists would look at this and they would say this is bad liberalism or it's ideology. They would read this as don't let ideological crusades get in the way of prudent power politics. But for Wolfers, that's only one source of this behavior. And this source of behavior can also be motivated by power political concerns, and it's still a bad idea. And that's pretty interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and okay. precisely what is problematic is the behavior. It's the infringement on, it's the lack of understanding of the subtleties of particular cases. But I come back to what we said before. It is ultimately for Wolfers a management problem, and it's a great power management problem. What it doesn't do and what Wolfers can't do is acknowledge that the transformational project that some of these states were engaged in was like an actual transformational project, which is Getachew's argument. And because that's not the way Wolfers is looking at this, right? It has to be, all of the policy is conducted from the perspective of what are the power interests of the United States in trying to maintain its particular rivalry. So it is, in that sense, these are essays on international politics and theory of international politics that is clearly written from a particular perspective, speaking to this particular audience, and with both the strengths and the limitations of that. Within its context, it's certainly a warning about ideological crusades, and it's a warning about, you know, counting up the countries in the world and seeing which of the columns they fall into and somehow thinking you've won if you've got more of them in your column and you've lost if they're in another column. He's like, no, that's dumb. But it is still limited in terms of how far it can go in terms of thinking about like power instruments and the rules of the system. It is still very much advice to the prince. It may be better advice to the prince, but it's certainly still advice to the prince.
This is the kind of work that people at our universities are criticized for all the time. Right?
Yes.
This is arguably a direction that my work has gone in. You know, it's the dominance of U.S. foreign policy. It's the lure of being in the imperial capital. It's the lure of knowing people who are inside and trying to be able to speak to them directly or indirectly, and the way in which that distorts your, just not even necessarily what you say, but what you focus on, right? And I think that's probably, you know, I think you're right that a better version of this argument would have taken much more seriously. And I think you're being a little bit unfair. I think he does take it. I mean, he doesn't completely dismiss it. He thinks they have a natural interest in self-determination. They really care about it, right? But he also says that this is an interest which is driven by power political considerations. They have to show their domestic population that they can stand up against imperialism and so on and so forth. But again, it's a weird argument because it's simultaneously like advice to the prince, but it's also actually quite empathetic. This is an example of what we call strategic empathy. Let us understand the kinds of constraints mm-hmm. and dilemmas that they are under.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's fair. That's fair. We already sort of started here, but we should probably end here as well with the that political theory and international relations chapter. I mean, that whole chapter, I mean, the fascinating thing about it is this is, look at, if you want to understand traditions of political thought, you have to understand the historical context out of which they come. And U.S. and British thought about international affairs is decisively influenced by them being islands and relatively strategically divorced from other things. So, of course, it's a little more moralistic because they, the countries in question, could afford to pursue these moral goals. Whereas continental Europe, people were always killing each other, and so that nobody had a choice. It was all a pull of compulsion. Everybody's always, this at least is argument, that everybody's sort of always arguing with each other and whatever. So, not moral goals. Instead, it's about, you know, strategic necessity and whatever. So that's sort of the
Patrick's contrast. Patrick is reacting to my rolling my eyes at some.
I am reacting to Dan rolling his eyes, and the summary that I just gave was not intended to be.
No, I think we understand
summary.
That's
my summary of what Wolfers is actually arguing. But what's interesting there is it is all about needing to understand the contextual specificity from which these notions come. So the Anglo-American tradition that he's very enamored of is a tradition that entertains the possibility of these sorts of moral goals and has a problem in that it sometimes inclines too far toward the pursuit of moral goals and needs to be reminded that there are these sorts of power and survival considerations that should be also taken into account. It's also fascinating to me that for him, the dating goes back to Thomas More in 1516. And Thucydides doesn't show up at all. So this is clearly before the weird backdating of the perennial realist tradition to the Greeks. But Thomas More gets to be included. So it's not 1648, it's not Hobbes, it's More. But then that becomes his picture of this particular kind of European tradition. And it's both, the tradition has to be rooted in a set of experiences. Theory is about summarizing the lessons from those experiences and bringing them forward and then figuring out how to intervene in them. So it's a fascinating self-location of what it is that he's trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would add to that is that the only thing I would add to what you just said is that the chapter is also interesting as an historical artifact, because the way it opens would be unrecognizable to current people in international relations and political science departments. Because what he says at the beginning is that in government and political science, essentially in departments that are political science departments, that is government and politics departments, everybody understands that political theory is the foundation upon which we build things. But in those IR departments, we don't have political theorists, and that's a problem. Which is almost kind of the inverse. I mean, I don't want to be too strong. There are places that remain committed to political theory. Georgetown is one of them. But, you know, the general view of political theorists is that they've been under siege for a while and that they're being cut out in political science. And yet in IR, we have a very rich tradition now of theory. We think about IR departments as the more pluralistic, the more friendly to people who are doing international thought overall, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, well, and you know, in my school, which is a school of international affairs, like we, until recently, haven't really had anybody doing political theory. We've had a few that have now been able to come in, and a few people who sort of, like, they do so. They come out of a political theory background, but they do like environmental politics or whatever. I agree. The account that he gives would be unrecognizable because we have had this epistemic shift as to what we think the foundations are. And it's fascinating to me that some people in the Guillot book that I've mentioned before, some people go back and try to read Wolfers and they read him as some sort of like quasi-behavioralist because he talks about empirics and wanting to see, but he's really not. I mean, his version of this is very much in the lines of a certain kind of classical political theory. So I guess I understand better, I guess I will say, we can loop back to that comment, that Niebuhr comment at the beginning that we kind of started out with, that he really is in some ways more of a political philosopher, a political theorist, even though he uses the language of science and he's very interested in empirics. But he's clearly not trying to say we need to base our policy on systematic empirical studies, which will tell us what the option is that has the best likelihood of success. That's not what he thinks theory is for, and that's not what he thinks scholarship in international affairs was.
Yeah, in a way, this is a vision of what we do in relation to policy, which bears a family resemblance to what Dan Dresner in his book on think tanks and whatever calls the public intellectual, as opposed to the thought leader.
Yeah.
That is to say that the role here is really to shoot down bad ideas, right? I mean, that's crude. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what Dan argues a public intellectual does, is they largely serve as a kind of public critic. Like, their goal is to essentially prevent people from falling prey to thought leaders. And part of his argument is we have too many thought leaders and not enough public intellectuals. But here, there's something. The reason I think this is cognate is that the goal here is not really to tell people what the recipe is to have a successful policy. It's to clarify. It's to cut through a lot of the noise to get at kind of essential questions.
Right.
Essential issues. There are times when he's willing to make he is willing to make general recommendations. He is willing to say that there are certain things you probably need to be really cognizant of, but he's not willing to give that special, you know, the special secret sequence that's going to get the algorithm that's going to get you what you want.
Right. Algorithm's good. Algorithm's a good word. It is very anti-algorithmic. In that sense, that there is no formula for being able to, there are certain things you kind of need to keep in mind, but it ultimately goes back to questions of judgment, moral judgment in particular, and surfacing dilemmas in a way that would not be unfamiliar to Morgenthau or Weber or something, but without some of the more heavy-handed theoretical postulates, shall we say. This is really, Wolfer's whole approach to this holds his theoretical commitments fairly simply. There's not a lot of detailed elaboration. And I don't know, do I actually want to say this? Maybe I do. This is what Mearsheimer thinks he's doing, but he's not. Because Mearsheimer is far too doctrinaire. But this is the style that Mearsheimer is aiming for, I think. In a way, this is kind of what Bob Jervis
does.
This
is very Jervisian.
And Jervis cites Wolfers as an influence. And mentions him as an influence. And as someone who... And it is not... surprising to me that when Bob Jervis was one of the co-teachers of 6801,
right, and then it stayed on when,
as soon as Bob was not teaching it anymore,
the year when it was Helen Miller, and she kept it on the syllabus for that year. How long it lasted on the syllabus, I don't know, but that syllabus was
overhung Bob. And
I don't remember talking about it very much, but it was on the syllabus.
Right, because I took 6801 when it was the two of them teaching it, and he talked about Wolfers a lot in not just the particular lecture where we're reading Wolfers, but he was referred to Wolfers at other times.
So a couple of things about that. I mean, the obvious question, which I think we'll just raise and not answer, because I think people who listen to the podcast know we would just say predictable things, which is that, is this a better route for realism than the route that realism took? But I think that's obviously we would say yes. But I think the caveat here is that there are ways in which this variant, a very kind of messy realism, is more similar to some ways of understanding structural realism, right? It's more complicated than that, right?
It is, and it if we if we understand structure in a more ideal typical sense, then I think we can
right or more we're analytical partial nature. Whatever the terms you want to use are.
Yes.
And whether you think that sort of you can accept certain kinds of claims in structuralism while substantively disagreeing with the inferences that are drawn from the logic, right? Where in this sense right. you would talk about Wendt as sort of the extreme version of, you know, kind of still in that wheelhouse, right, which is the standard criticism of him. Mm-hmm. And that it's not surprising that you could get somebody who is fairly loose about their understanding about any kind of environmental determinants sort of running the same thought experiment that Alex runs when he talks about, you know, anarchy being an empty structure and what matters is the history of interaction among states. The other thing, but it's also easy to see why works like this didn't become dominant, because it's hard to sell this kind of stuff in a particular kind of environment where we are, you know, the behavioral environment, right? Even though he is somebody who's basically like, go do behaviorism, that's awesome. Right? Go do those experiments. They're really helpful.
Well, but,
again, very Dervisian.
Right, but go do them and then go do them, but then understand their contribution to the overall knowledge project, mm-hmm. not as being the inescapable epistemic foundation of nothing can be knowledge unless it passes through these.
I mean, he lists animal experiments alongside like children and adults as like three baskets that would be useful, which I think is a bit of a tell, right?
Sure. Yeah, exactly. It's very eclectic, not in the sense that word is sometimes used now in the field, but it's eclectic in, okay, cool, let's pursue knowledge. Let's pursue and sort of see where we can find things and if it's useful insights. But the recurrent refrain, the kind of realist sympathy, the symphony that keeps running through this, skepticism of maximalist ideal goals, transformation is usually a mask for something else. Don't be too quick to give up on your own needs to preserve your own security and your own existence. And then the details can vary quite a lot. So I think we look in vain for some sort of Lakatosian hardcore of something called realism, but we could easily see a core family resemblance.
Let's say we don't have a hardcore, we have a series of leitmotifs.
I like leitmotifs. I like that. Recurrent gestures is what I would sometimes say, but yeah, a leitmotif is good.
I mean, I think one of the tasks now, if you want to think about, I am completely biased, right? I mean, because basically the project I'm trying to do now with Stacy and Paul is a project that is really kind of Wolfers 2.0. That is, it's a elevate. Mm-hmm. It is very much in this tradition, but incorporating big developments in how we think about social science, how we, you know, the kinds of intellectual and methodological tools available to us, updating it to get out of some of the, you know, advice for the prince kind of perspective, updating some of the attitudes about social conditions. There's a lot, you know, I would say attitudes, some of the assumptions, right, about social conditions. It's not clear that how Wolfers thinks about any of those. But yeah, I mean, sort of a sense I was going to say, you know, so I think that this kind of work needs to be updated, but I say that in a completely non-disinterested way, because in a sense that is what Stacy, Paul, and I are doing, is we're trying to update this kind of argument. I think Glenmorangie is fine, but it's not really my cup of tea.
Glenmorangie is the first actual serious whiskey that I ever had. It was Ivor Newman introduced me to it, and mm-hmm. it was okay, and then I started having other stuff and realized that it was okay.
I guess I would describe it as, yeah, I think you're right, the cigar-smoking, hanging out, talking thing, it's perfectly adequate. It doesn't have a lot of personality. It's like the Sis of whiskeys. Mm-hmm.
That would be it. Yes, I agree. I agree. Not a bad thing to start with, but hopefully people get more.
All right. Well, let's say goodbye to everybody. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.
I hope you have found some good whiskey to sip as you listen to this podcast.